On January the 3rd, US forces lifted a head of state from a South American country and transported him over 2,000 miles to a prison in New York. "We are running Venezuela now," said Donald Trump. In fact, the deposed dictator's deputy seems to be in charge, and according to the US president, making oil deals with the US. Meanwhile, the US State Department declares that it's our hemisphere, and White House aides threaten US intervention in a range of territories from Colombia to Greenland. So, what does running Venezuela mean? Is it all about the oil? And who's next? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. To try and get a handle on all this, I'm joined by Hal Hodson, America's editor for The Economist, Christopher Sabatini, senior research fellow for Latin America at Chatham House in London, and Vanda Felbad-Brown, senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution in Washington. First, let's take a quick look at the recent history of Venezuela. It was a Spanish colony until the early 19th century, but after that came a long period of dictators and military juntas interspersed with attempts at democracy. And by the 80s, it was pretty wealthy from oil and a democratically elected government was in place. And it should have been one of the richest countries in South America. But it didn't work out that way. Vanda Felbad-Brown, what was Venezuela like in the 1980s?
Let me start just a little bit talking about the 70s, which it is when it is a tremendously rich country, following this surge in oil prices, where people talk about Venezuela as Saudi Venezuela. And you have tremendous per capita income at the time, 80% of US per capita income. And then come the 80s, price bust, crisis, social unrest. The oil glut of the 1980s causes, of course, a tremendous fall in revenues, and that leads to foreign debt inflation. It leads to all kinds of fiscal challenges for the country that then ultimately a decade later accumulate in neoliberal reforms prescribed by the IMF, and they cause violent protests. And instead of the 1990s, decade, the beginning of the 1990s, a social morass, social frustration, rejection of the traditional parties, and first the attempt at a coup d'etat by Hugo Chavez and ultimately his election.
And Chavez was what, in the army, and therefore he led an army coup d'etat in the first instance?
Exactly. Chavez was a lieutenant colonel. That was the highest rank he achieved. He attempted to lead a coup d'etat in 1992, failed at it, was jailed. But after he released from jail, he establishes a new political vehicle. I don't even want to say political party. The traditional parties are just discredited by the morass of the late 1980s and 1990s. And he is elected amidst this enormous political frustration and economic challenges in 1998.
So essentially, the oil wealth had disappeared. The country was embarked upon what a kind of austerity, and it's discontent with that that leads to Chavez being elected.
Absolutely. It's the typical story of Latin America, whose income so much depends on the prices of commodities. And when they go bust, this then leads to inability to overcome that, have more sustained economic growth that would not be so vulnerable to external shocks. And that, of course, fuels the political disenchantment with the traditional party system.
Christopher, Chavez takes over. And you would have thought, given all this kind of oil wealth and the uptick in the oil markets, that everything's going to go pretty well. So tell us what happens under Chavez.
Chavez engaged in two specific things. One was a political project to consolidate power and to basically turn the Venezuelan state into a single party state. So new constitution, politicization of the armed forces, formation of a number of paramilitary groups like the colectivas, which are allied with the government but are private, as well as the full corruption of the National Guard, the National Police, and the military by basically devolving to them authority that allowed them to extract rents from all sorts of illicit activities. Chavez died in 2013 from cancer, and he handpicked his successor, Nicolas Maduro, who followed and in many ways doubled down on many of the more corrupt and more autocratic paths that Chavez has initiated. But he also lacked that charisma. And at that point, this economy started to tank. Gas prices and oil prices were collapsing. The Chavez government had broken the independence of the central bank, raided its hard currency reserves, broken the semi-independence of the state oil company, and raided its profits. And so basically, they were left bankrupt. And a lot of this money had simply just hemorrhaged out of the country in terms of extravagant purchases, a very complicated exchange rate policy, as well as corruption. And so Maduro was left with an economic disaster when he was first elected in 2013. In 2018, the economy collapsed by two-thirds, making poverty close to 1.80% of the population. So he inherited a huge fiscal mess, but did nothing to correct it.
Right. And there were elections after that. What happened?
The integrity of elections has steadily deteriorated since Hugo Chavez's time. The election commission has been completely packed with loyalists. And so every election from 2013, when Maduro was first elected, to 2018, when he was reelected, and even 2024, most recently, was not conducted under free and fair conditions, leaving many people to question the legitimacy, with reason, to question the legitimacy of the Maduro regime and its elected mandate.
Hal Hodson, who's running Venezuela right now?
Well, it depends what you mean by run. If you listen to Donald Trump, he says that he is running the country. And what he seems to mean by that is that he has kind of chosen a person in Venezuela to administrate it, and he will keep them in line by threat of force, essentially. Do what I want or else. His Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, is going to be the kind of administrative guy talking to Venezuela. But it turns out that the person that they've chosen is Nicolas Maduro's handpicked vice president, Delcy Rodriguez.
So, Chris, tell us about this Delcy Rodriguez.
Basically, Delcy was sort of gained a reputation as a pragmatic deal maker and, in many ways, a public face of the government to investors, both oil investors as well as financial sector investors and the large number of bondholders of the $160 billion worth of Venezuelan debt plus interest that's been defaulted. She also had what unfortunately was a rarity in the Chavez and Maduro government. She actually had a team of economists. That actually, despite the economic disasters, or perhaps this is what led to them, arguably, there really weren't economists in the Maduro government until then. So she was seen as being a technocrat, even though she herself, she'd studied in France and studied in the UK, wasn't really, you know, a typical technocrat. She did bring together a team. And so she was really well respected by a number of the investors and seems a can-do person. And she turned around the economy, as Vondo was saying. I mean, not dramatically, but she did restore
oil
production.
But she was seen by Maduro as being safe enough to be made vice president.
Yeah, she is a loyal camper, if you will, for Maduro. She and her brother's Jorge Rodriguez, he's the president of the National Assembly. They have an interesting story because they, in many ways, are sort of the diehard Chavistas of the original sort of Marxist school, if you will. Jorge and Delcy's father was a Marxist revolutionary who was killed by police forces or security forces in prison. So they're kind of they have this iconic image within Venezuela as standing for a very ideological but sort of pro-socialist, non-corrupt era. But she is part and parcel of this government. She would have stayed in this long if she weren't somehow involved in all of the nefarious activities the government's involved in.
Chris, what's the situation been like for ordinary Venezuelans?
I think what you've seen over the course of the last, well, decades, but slowly, but it's accelerated, is basically people's need to survive day by day. Because the state has become so hollowed out, so corrupt, so basically become a vehicle for the economic interests of the elite, in particular the military.
And just on that point, I think that the elites are managing things. They're managing things for their own enrichment and their own empowerment. They're not managing anything for the Venezuelan on the street. The only thing that's being managed for the Venezuelan on the street is ensuring that they don't mess with the elite's continued accumulation of wealth and power. And that's about the colectivos and about the military.
The same regime is essentially in place, minus Maduro, with the threat hanging over it continuously of further American military action. I suppose the question comes, how many various leaders of Venezuela you can take out before you haven't got any left to rely upon. But one of the things which seems to be missing from all this is the question of the people who actually, a large part of the world, thought did win those elections. Now, some thought that a lot of this was about democracy and was about the people who we thought had really won the elections. What's happened to them?
very little has happened to them. And I don't believe that anyone in the Trump administration has said the name Edmundo González since they took Maduro. Edmundo González is the rightfully elected president of Venezuela. There is no doubt in my mind. I don't think there should be any doubt in anyone's mind. We know this because the opposition mounted this incredible campaign during the 2024 election to go and collect tallies from something like 80% of all ballot boxes in Venezuela to prove that they had won the election. And they did that. And Chris can probably correct me on the exact figures, but I think they won by something like 65-35. And Maduro just turned around and said, no, you didn't. We won by 55-45. That's the end of it. So where is the opposition now? Edmundo González is in Spain, and I believe Maria Corina Machado is still in Norway. I'm not 100% sure where she is.
She's somewhere in Europe.
And Trump doesn't seem very interested in the transition to democracy. He's said it a couple of times vaguely that, you know, there'll be a just transition at some point. But I think a good way of thinking about this is that in Iraq, Iraq is a great contrast for this particular point. In Iraq, the Americans went in and tried to install, you know, a path to democracy. And Trump criticized them for not taking the oil. In Venezuela, he's doing it exactly backwards. He's taking the oil and democracy can come later, maybe.
Chris, can you remind us who Maria Corina Machado actually is?
She's a long-standing civil society and political activist in Venezuela. She really came to prominence in 2004 when she organized a petition signing campaign for a recall referendum against then-President Hugo Chavez, an organization called Sumate, which then monitored the elections. She then herself ran for office, but then she was prohibited from running for office by the Supreme Court, which is fully in the pocket of Nicolas Maduro. And so she looked like she was going to be left out in the run-up to the 2024 elections. But Edmundo González, a little-known retired diplomat, had thrown his hat in the ring. And once she was prohibited, she threw her weight behind him. And she campaigned across the country. She was prohibited from flying. She went in caravans from almost every town, city across Venezuela, filling plazas, filling streets, demanding the citizen vote. But since then, she's been in hiding. She's been threatened by the Maduro government, and she just left just a few weeks ago to Oslo to receive the Nobel Peace Prize.
Vanda, briefly, can you tell us why the Trump administration didn't simply say, well, we demand that she be put in office?
Well, I think that still remains a puzzle. Machado very strongly supported the Trump administration from the moment that he was elected. She reached out to the Trump administration. She became a very strong, staunch supporter of the military intervention that the Trump administration threatened across the entire 2025 and was building up toward. She did everything to be close to the Trump administration. And without doubt, she is the person with the democratic credentials. Now, you have this big turnaround. Why did it happen? I think the most important reason is that the Trump administration finds it far easier or believes it will be far easier to rule through the regime without having to change political structures. Now, I think that will run to ground, this notion, but I think that's the primary motivation.
How?
Yeah, I think it goes slightly beyond that. I actually think that this choice is one of the things the Trump administration has done is this, that you can kind of see in a... is sort of maybe reasonable. The CIA assessment of the opposition's ability to run Venezuela is very, very poor. And that is because the opposition does not control the military. That's as simple as that. So the idea that you could just parachute in Machado, even though there is democratic will, you would have this lump of 100,000 troops and all those generals between the opposition and the people. And that's just a recipe for conflict and chaos. And that's exactly what the Trump administration doesn't want. And the other point that hasn't been mentioned is that Delcy is the minister for oil. She is the oil lady. And that's what Trump cares about. And I've never heard Maria Corina Machado talk about how it would be great to get the oil flowing again. Whereas, and we know that not just the Trump administration's assessment, but the American oil industry's assessment is that Delcy's their girl.
Right. I think this is the moment to jump to the oil question. How important a motivation, Christopher, is Venezuelan oil for what Trump has done in your assessment?
I think at a personal level, it is very important for Trump because he views the world and his role and the U.S.'s power to be used in the exercise of increasing U.S. economic and geopolitical power. And for him, sort of an old school, almost, if you will, sort of 19th century transactional colonialist or imperialist, he sees the oil as being important. But quite frankly, I don't think that was a primary motivation. He sees it because he sees it, first of all, as a win. He wants to present it to his MAGA base. And for a lot of the base, lower prices at the gas tanks, which this will not result in, by the way, is an important motivating factor.
How can we stick to the oil for a moment? I mean, Chris has essentially said that oil is more of a symbol than a reality. Can you give me your assessment of that?
There's a short term and a long term. In the short term, the administration says it is working on a deal with PVDSA, the state oil company, to get existing oil that is in storage. There's loads and loads of Venezuelan oil sitting in storage tanks because they haven't been able to export it because the Americans have this embargo. So the Americans are saying, right, we'll take that and we'll sell it on the market and we'll do whatever we want with the money, including maybe giving it back to some Venezuelans. But who knows? That's the short term plan. The long term plan from Trump is to get American oil companies to invest billions and billions of dollars into the Venezuelan oil fields, oil infrastructure. The short-term plan, they can probably do. I mean, there's lots of questions about why would the regime do that? That seems like, but that's very live. That those negotiations are happening right now. The long-term plan is full of holes.
Why?
Because oil is not oil. Oil in Saudi Arabia is completely different than oil in Venezuela. Oil in Venezuela is actually tar. It is under the ground a long, long way. You can't just suck it up with a straw. You have to send this giant digger down with a huge chamber behind it, and you have to tunnel your way through this tar, inject a bunch of chemicals down there to make it liquefy, and then slurp it all back up. It is an incredibly expensive, incredibly energy-intensive operation. The Venezuelan electricity grid is a disaster that cannot supply enough energy to anyone to do any of this. So when Trump talks about investing billions and billions of dollars, but private companies are going to do this, what he's saying is that it's so bizarre. This is one of the most bizarre things about the whole, in a whole series of bizarre things. He's saying that private companies will choose to invest lots and lots of capital in a place where oil is very expensive to extract, in a place where there are no property rights effectively, in a world where the secular trend for oil prices is to be curbing and eventually coming down. So he's saying we're going to make a huge investment with very poor possibility of returns. And I just don't see how that is possible.
Chris, can I just ask you a quick question? One of the things that's been claimed, I think, is that actually, in some funny way, this is America's oil because it was all taken from American companies and so on. This is a historical claim. Is there a degree of truth to that?
There is, but it's ahistorical the way Donald Trump is presenting it. The oil fields and the state oil company sort of became the center player in the Venezuelan oil industry in the 1970s when oil fields were nationalized. There were a few expropriations under Hugo Chavez of ConocoPhillips and ExxonMobil. Those are still being negotiated. It's about $10 billion worth of disputed claims. The truth is it isn't U.S. oil. Yes, the Rockefellers did play a huge role in the exploration, extraction of oil in the 50s and 60s. In Venezuela, but you know, it was never U.S. oil. It was simply U.S. companies that were investing and extracting that and refining it. We did a study at Chatham House in 2021 of what would be necessary because of the lack of reinvestment, because of the gutting of engineers and technocratic staff within the state oil company, and because of illegal process and framework and regulatory framework that's completely out of whack and very confusing and very favorable to the government. It will take anywhere between $100 billion to $280 billion of foreign investment to get Venezuela's oil production back up to where it was in the late 1990s, which is about 3 million barrels.
I want to move us on very briefly to drugs, because this is the other major pretext for American action. We did a program about Venezuela fairly recently, and about the area. And one of the things that we discovered was that insofar as Venezuela was responsible for the trafficking of drugs, it was cocaine and not the fentanyl, which people worry most about, and that most of it was to Europe rather than to the US. Is there anything that you want to tell me that will alter that assessment, Hal?
Well, I think there's a narrow lens on this, which is Maduro, right? it was Maduro involved in cocaine trafficking at a high level? One of his charges is machine gun possession, which basically means deploying guns either through instruction or yourself to protect your trafficking operation. I think there's very little doubt that somewhere beneath him, there were people with his full knowledge making loads of money smuggling cocaine somewhere. I don't think it necessarily has to be to the United States for that to be a crime. And for sure, some of it went to the United States somehow in some court in some way. But the bigger point is, was drug trafficking a really important strategic reason for the Americans to go into Venezuela and seize Maduro and conduct this run Venezuela? The proof is in the pudding. The proof is in the way they speak afterwards. Has anyone mentioned drug trafficking since they captured Maduro? I haven't heard it.
Well, even in the indictment that he's now facing in New York courts, it doesn't mention fentanyl. And Donald Trump was explicit that Maduro was basically trafficking fentanyl in the United States.
Okay, I want to move us on to where we go from here, because what's interesting about what you've said is it probably won't make any difference to the drugs. It probably won't end up in some great kind of oil bonanza for the United States or indeed for anyone else. And for the moment, it doesn't look as if it's going to lead to a democratic transition in Venezuela, which makes it look as if a lot of this is symbolic or about the projection of power. Now, Vander, Donald Trump had this press conference aboard a plane, and he was asked about several countries, and he kind of numbered them down in the region. They all seemed to have problems that he felt the United States should do something about. Is it your impression that what has happened in Venezuela is the forerunner of other interventions of one sort or another in the Western Hemisphere?
Well, I definitely believe that the actions in Venezuela were about projection of power. It is putting the so-called Donald Trump doctrine in place.
So this is a kind of modification of the old Monroe doctrine, in which Latin America and Caribbean are all said to be in the United States' backyard and no one else had better mess with it.
Correct. That's how the president now speaks about it. I do think, though, that there were also circumstances specific to Venezuela where a set of factors came together. Cuba, that we haven't talked about, and the notion that Venezuela, bringing down the regime in Venezuela, is a twofer, will sever the oil line to Cuba, and this will bring down Cuba. And you have, this euphoria that the President Trump projects from Saturday on after the success of the operation, and then outlines, along with Secretary Rubio, a set of countries that should be worried. Now, these include Cuba, the core motivation for Secretary Rubio, Colombia. But I think most stunningly, we see a resurrection of actions, of military action or other coercion against Greenland, which is something that the Trump administration has been saying needs to become the island of Greenland, needs to become part of the United States, although whether this is through purchase or through military coercion would clearly be blatant, naked annexation of a sovereign country, of a sovereign people, who also happen to be part of a core US ally, Denmark, under NATO.
Let's stick for the moment to the question about what happens within Latin and Central America, particularly to the point that Vander raised about Cuba, Hal. Is it the perception that Cuba is now very vulnerable, now this big ally of it may be susceptible to American pressure?
Cuba was already incredibly vulnerable. Cuba has been a broken state for many, many years. A colleague of mine, Zan Smiley, just went there and sent back a desperate report about the state of, he spent his career in Africa, and he says that the streets on Havana feel worse to him and more dangerous and more deprived than some of the worst cities he spent time in sub-Saharan Africa. So that's shocking to me. And that was before any of this went down. Cuba is extremely vulnerable. It's had Venezuela cut off its fuel.
Chris, do you think fairly soon we'll be making a program about Cuba?
I think so. But the truth is, let's look back at the history of U.S.-Cuban relations. There's always been this sense of imminent collapse of the Cuban regime. I mean, the embargo has been in place since 1962, Okay, it's still ongoing. And it's funny because the advocates of embargoes or sanctions, broad economic sanctions, like they understand the nature of regime evil. They really do. They're trying to use economic statecraft to punish and bring a regime for it to leave. The problem is what they don't understand, despite the fact their understanding of evil, is the fact that regimes don't care about what the citizens think. They just want to stay in power. So this idea of inflicting pain on the Cuban people and watching it deteriorate, watching rolling blackouts, hospitals decay, schools not be able to convene, that doesn't matter to the Cuban government. So in fact, this link between inflicting more suffering and a Cuban regime collapse is quite tenuous. We haven't seen it happen yet. It may happen now, but with a huge cost. And I'll just say this, because I know Al wants to say something, is I met, I won't say who, with the Supreme Commander of U.S. Southern Command. And he told me the biggest security threat I see is a collapse of the Cuban government with massive waves of migrants coming across the Florida Straits into Florida, and then a lot of that territory being taken over by drug cartels.
Hal, that brings me to the final question I wanted to ask. These things very rarely pan out as people plan or imagine them to be. You create a kind of best case scenario, maybe you look at some of the risks, etc., and then it doesn't quite work out. What do you think the dangers are for the, if you like, the Donroe Doctrine in practice for America, the risks for America?
Yeah, I think the risks are mostly for America. I think that this is an attempt to project power, and it, you know, narrowly a successful one. They got their guy. He's in jail in Brooklyn. It is an attempt to project power that I believe America will not be able to sustain. What America is saying to its neighbors and allies with this action and with the statements after the action is this is our hemisphere. That's literally just the State Department's line now. This is our hemisphere. We do what we want to whoever we want, however we want, and no one can stop us or ask questions. And that's just not. That's not going to work. And just economically, the cost of running things through violence is higher than the cost of running things through cooperation and persuasion and collaboration. All those soft woke terms, I presume collaboration's woke now. But I just think they're going to fail. And Venezuela is now this crucible for this Trumpian illiberal intervention, this new way of running his hemisphere. And my own personal view is that it is not going to go well. I don't think it's going to go well because I think Venezuela is going to implode. I think the regime is just going to cement control. I think that the Americans are going to get almost nothing out of this. Whether or not that's embarrassing for Donald Trump depends on how well he and the MAGA movement just moves on to the next thing. And historically, they're pretty damn good at moving on to the next thing and just shrugging off whatever chaos they leave in their wake.
That's all we've got time for. My thanks to Christopher Sabatini, Hal Hodson, and Vanda Felbab-Brown. And my conclusion, the certainties on which so much post-Cold War Western policy had been based are being shattered. Only one thing seems to me to be sure. It won't end up where the mold breakers think it will. We'll be back in February. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey and Kirstine Knight. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundele, and the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hello, I'm Amol Rajan, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Radical. We are living through one of those hinge moments in history when all the old certainties crumble and a new world struggles to be born. So the idea behind this podcast is to help you navigate it.
What's really changed is the volume of information. That has exploded.
And also by offering a safe space for the radical ideas that our future demands.
Go to the Chancellor and say, radically cut the taxes of those with children.
Telling our stories is powerful and a radical act.
Listen to Radical with Amol Rajan on BBC Sounds.